you go ahead and help skip these horizons through your little plane?
I thought I saw Jeremy.
It's not a big deal.
He sent me an email saying he's working the day shift. And no, I sent it.
No variance, no nothing.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. We will bring to order the special meeting for National Park and Recreation Commission tonight here in the Grove on November 18th. And we will be discussing some action items tonight as well as several informational items. Anybody that wishes to speak on an item that's on our agenda, fills out one of these, and it looks like everybody has. So our first agenda item is actually public forum. I don't see anyone here to speak. I would be speaking on an item that isn't on our agenda tonight. So I'll move on to item number three, which is additions or deletions to the agenda. I have none if I don't see any from staff or commissioners. So we'll move to number four, unfinished business. And first up on the agenda tonight is the revenue bond, additional project funding, and we are hoping to take action tonight on this. So I'll turn it over to Director Black.
Okay. So just to be clear, tonight we're talking about the CIP and maintenance bond. A portion of that was already approved with the swimming pool. But what I'm coming back with you today is to talk about an additional $300,000 that I would like to propose that we add to this CIP bond and make it a CIP and maintenance bond. And I'll explain that in a minute. The pool was approved in October for $2.6 million, and we're working on designing right now, and we're working on taking that revenue bond to the City Council for their final stamp of approval so we can get that project underway. I brought to you some additional items that I said would be prudent to add to the bond so that we could group a couple of what I would consider high-impact CIP projects for the community. And by high-impact, I mean that they would serve a lot of people. There are a couple of things that people have been looking for quite a while and would be really happy to see happen. And this would be a great opportunity. Those two things are to do the pickleball courts, which we've talked about at Oak Knoll Golf Course, and then to resurface the tennis courts at Hunter and maybe Lithia Park as well, but primarily Hunter, which is something that is a maintenance project, and that's the maintenance side of the CIP and maintenance bond. It's a large maintenance item, about $150,000. And part of the expense on that is, it's not just resurfacing, which I guess I should talk about right now, but the $150,000 would also cover doing some extra reinforcement to the cracks that already exist so that they don't crack further, or at least in theory they wouldn't crack further, so that we just don't overlay the tennis courts and then get cracks in the exact same place whereas they were before. So it'd be armoring basically underneath so that we have a better shot of this nice smooth surface lasting as long as possible. The pickleball courts, I'm just going to go ahead and jump forward here really quick. So as I reported previously, the food and beverage tax, which is where the revenue bond money would come from, is about $750,000 to $800,000 per year. That's 25% of the total tax that comes to Ashland Parks and Recreation. It expires in 2030, so we have time to get in a 10-year bond. If we act quickly, we can get in a 10-year bond before the end of the food and beverage tax. The projects that I'm proposing are consistent with the food and beverage tax, as I'll show you in a minute, and we do have the capacity at this point to do that. So back to what I was talking about a minute ago. So the funding proposal is simple, and I'm not bringing, tonight I'm just bringing the funding proposal to you. The designs for some of the things that we're going to be talking about, especially the pickleball courts, those will come back to you at another point in time as we're currently working on those designs. But pickleball, I'm estimating right now, and I'll show you the conceptual design in a minute, but I'm estimating right now that pickleball is going to cost about $325,000 to do 6 pickleball courts, dedicated pickleball courts. There's a little bit extra in there because the site we're choosing to use, which seems to work really well for a lot of reasons, as I pointed out in the staff report, is near the driving range, which requires moving the driving range a little bit. We had $175,000 in there, so I'm in the CIP, which is the capital improvement plan. So we have $175,000 balance from food and beverage already. That's not going to be enough to complete the project. I think we need $325,000 minimum. So I'm proposing to add $150,000 from the bond towards the pickleball project. In addition, I'm also asking to consider $150,000 towards the resurfacing and armoring and potentially upgrading some of the other accoutrements that go along with the tennis courts at Hunter Park for $150,000. Some of you noticed that I didn't include Lithia Park in my staff report, and the reason for that is we're still looking at getting figures, and at this point in time, without the project 100% identified or without having a bid in place, I'm confident that with the quote that we have, I'm confident that we can accomplish Hunter Park for less than $150,000. I'm not 100% confident that there will be enough left over to do Lithia Park tennis courts. But in the conversation that we can have tonight, there is an opportunity through the Parks Foundation that we could potentially add another $25,000 that's been dedicated to Lithia Park, if the commissioners would like to do that, to make sure that the Lithia Park tennis courts get done without adding more money to the bond. And that's, or we could potentially wait and see what CIP projects get done and see if there's any capacity in food and beverage at the end of the biennium and try to do it then. So obviously there's cost savings for doing it all at once, not having them come down twice. It does make a lot more sense to do it all at once. So the option is to make sure Lithia Park courts get done, to add another $25,000 to the bond, or to direct me to seek $25,000 from the Lithia Park line item in the Parks Foundation and add that to the project. So the total cost as I'm proposing it right now, not including Lithia Park tennis courts, is $3,075,000. The total bond would be $2,900,000. And then the total that's already in CIP, which is food and beverage that already exists, already budgeted, is $175,000. That's how we come up with the $3,075,000. Question?
You're saying that doing the Lithia Park and the Hunter Park tennis courts at the same time is a cost savings, correct?
There certainly should be a cost savings there because it's just economies of scale.
And so you're giving us the option of either put it in the bond or to assume we can get the extra from designated money from the foundation.
Well, the money in the foundation belongs to Lithia Park, and it's at the direction of the commissioners if you want me to seek that. The foundation is holding that money for Lithia Park. If that's the way you want to use the money, then I think the foundation would be, unless there's something else going on that I don't know about, the foundation should go along with that. But there is... Yeah, I mean, that's what I'm saying.
And the other thing is, I'm noticing it's surprising to me that that moving the location doubles the price, because there was a parking lot at the other site, and it would have basically have been demolished, I think, put in the pickleball courts there. So I'm just not... I'm a little surprised to get a little sticker shock by the the amount of increase in changing the site.
Well, and 175 was low. I mean, it was looking at a site that had already been used for a parking lot for some period of time, and would just require leveling out, maybe some retaining walls, and putting the pickleball courts in there. Yeah.
So I would just say, when we originally designated that $175,000 for pickleball, it wasn't. We spoke even at the time that the cost was going to probably be more than that, but that's what we set aside at the time, as I recall the discussion going. In other words, that money was probably not going to cover, you know, a full project, but it was kind of like, let's get started, let's put this as we're dividing up our CIP money.
So follow up question.
Yeah.
Is that okay with you, Jim?
Yeah, sure.
Then, if we are we really saying then that probably if we were to have stayed up in the parking lot up by the pro shop, that 175 would not have covered that?
What I said was 175 was low. I don't know how far it would have gone. We were kind of going off of a template that was used in another municipality. However, there were a lot of things that were different in that municipality. And, you know, we can't exactly replicate what they did because we don't have the same site that they had. But yes, I do think $175,000 was low. And we hadn't received any bids yet.
And now you have bids.
No, we don't have bids, but we've got some estimates that are putting us closer to this $325,000. We are at a position right now where we need to act, otherwise we're going to kind of miss the boat on this revenue bond. And we're currently in progress designing these pickleball courts. And we have several options that I'm going to show to you as we go forward that makes me confident that we can do it for $325,000. But not for $175,000. And I'll show you some of the concept and some of the options that we have to reduce costs going forward if we have to.
Jim?
I think the staff report mentioned not only trying to utilize a parking lot and some of the issues that had, but also remodeling the driving range, which means moving the nets and moving that whole establishment forward. And in my estimation, I don't know a lot about pickleball, but that seems like a fairly dynamic six-court spot in town that, to me, I want to hear from people who are actually pickleballers and see how all that design will work. But, when I looked at it, I realized that maybe alleviate some of the report from the paddle, it'd be less of a problem, and also just having all those six courts together, tournaments seem to work. So many things would seem to fall into place there. It is a more dynamic design than I think it started out to be.
Yeah, I think it's a much better location, and I'll show you more about the location in a minute. But just for the record, because this is a special meeting, I just want to get on the record that the food and beverage tax was created for these types of CIP projects to acquire property, plan, develop, and repair and rehab city parks. And we are looking at an average in the last few years of around $775,000. But when we're doing our budgeting and forecasting, we're using $750,000. So we're going with the lowest rate that we have a history of over the last 3 years. Just to be as conservative as possible, and so that we don't over budget or over burden the money that we are getting from food and beverage. Again, for the record, some of the projects that have been done in the past with food and beverage were just like this project. The ice rink cover, just the cover, talking about cost, just the cover down there is $300,000, which I think now would probably be double that. But the Calle Guanajuato surfacing, the Ashton Creek Park, about $500,000 of that was from food and beverage. The rest was from a a grant from the Oregon's Parks and Recreation Department, local government's grant. The Garfield Park Water Play, which is $850,000, plus all the renovations that happened with the volleyball,
basketball,
and some of the other things that we were able to improve while we were there is about $850,000, and we did get a revenue bond for that, and we're still paying on that. The Mace property purchase was an 11-acre property that we purchased for $380,000 that will provide a vital link, a pedestrian bicycle link between Oak Street and North Mountain that we think is really important. And Briscoe Park, which is probably one of the more exciting things that we were able to accomplish with food and beverage over the last few years to ensure that Briscoe Park stays a public park because it's now owned by Ashland Parks and Recreation. I think that was a really big win for food and beverage. Rick, did you have a question?
Yeah, just want to clarify on your on the staff report. It says the current encumbrances on the tax funds are 25% of anticipated income. Does that mean 25% between now and in 2030?
No, it's 25% of what's going out is 25% of $750,000. So if you look up here right now, what's going out right now, those three things right now is about set 25%. If you add the pool onto that, it goes up to about 65%. Okay? And then we're gonna add, in just a second, we're gonna add the money for the rest of this.
So then, that's my point then, is that it's 65% is what will be once this bond is approved and we pay, make our first payment from our food and beverage. And then after a few years, it's gonna go back down.
It is. If you look at the till 2030, this is with the pickleball courts and the tennis included, $325,000 a year. 2020, we don't make a payment. 2021, we do. And then from there, it starts going down until we get to 2028, and it drops off significantly because we pay out some other debts. So it doesn't stay 65%. It starts to go down, and the percentage also not only does the payment, the number going out go down, but the number coming in should rise as well. You know, we don't have a crystal ball, we can't see the future, but barring any major changes to the economy, to anything that affects the economy, we can expect around 750 plus per year with food and beverage. And that's what this is based on, and the percentages are based on. So, I might skip over this really quick, but I'm going to go over this really quick, so that everyone understands that what I'm proposing here is a bundle of projects. And the projects actually starts with the pool. There's $115,000 that's currently in food and beverage that we could actually add to the total, because that money is being used right now to help get the pool design going. We're working on the RFP, and we're trying to get that out. And so that project is underway. The RFP should be going out soon. The pickleball courts, we're looking at, I'm sorry, there's a mistake there. It's an increase of $150,000, but the $325,000 is correct. The tennis courts, $150,000. That's an increase of $150,000 because this is a maintenance project. It was not in CIP. We are saying that because of the impact that we can have with this project and the need for this project, that we think that it would be worthwhile to add this to the bond to get this maintenance project done sooner. And so that's a total of, and then the pool is $2.6 million. So you add that all up, and that's the total bundle of the projects. But like I said, $115,000 plus $175,000, which I believe is $290,000, is already in CIP, and that money is going towards the design of the pool at $115,000, and a portion of the pickleball courts at $175,000, which is already cash that's in the budget. So going forward, I'll just run you through the concept really quick. And again, I just want to point out again, I'm not bringing this here tonight for you guys to approve the design. I have floated the design past people. I've had some feedback. There are some changes that we're looking at making, but generally the design is, is going to be something like what I'm about to show you, but I'm going to bring that back to you after we go through the engineering process and talk more with the community and get some more feedback. But we're not approving the design tonight, but I am showing you what the idea is. So just as a point of reference, the clubhouse is right up the hill, right up here. You can see north down in the left corner. North is kind of going up towards the right. So north isn't straight up and down. We got the road coming in to the golf course and going out to the highway. And then right now for the driving range, there's this asphalt parking area. That exists right now. We have the driving range where people actually hit the balls. And then we have a cover over top of that with a shed. And that basically, with the driving range itself and the netting, is the driving range facility. So moving forward, what we're looking at here is a concept of what I think we could do to make a pickleball facility at the same location. And I'm going to see if I can get my pointer here. So we have the... Do I have any? No. We have the road, just like I showed you in the last drawing or the last aerial. This is the, you can see right under here, see that line? That's underneath here is the survey, and that's where the asphalt is for the current driving range. This darker gray area sitting on top of the survey, that's an area that I'm proposing that we could create for a parking area, which has, you know, depending on how far we go into this hillside over here, could be anywhere from 8 to 10 stalls. It would require some retaining up on the hillside here. But one of the other things we have to look out for is there is a maintenance road that comes back this way, and we need to ensure that that stays open for staff to use so that we can still get to the places we need to get to for stormwater and for maintenance of the actual golf course. So we've got the parking area here. This right here is what I call the pickleball facility, which is it's a pretty large area, but we've got 6 standard pickleball courts. We've got these two that are kind of facing northeast, and then we've got these two that are basically facing west. The reason why this one is, in the concept anyways, the reason why this one's facing like this is because of the road up here. Plus, I also thought with this hillside up here, it makes a natural amphitheater seating area where you can actually see what's going on down here without having to build in spectator seating, things like that. So again, we have the 6 pickleball courts, which would be most likely asphalt with a 12-inch concrete curbing all the way around and fencing all the way around at about 5 feet tall and fencing in the middle, just, you know, not consistent fencing all the way down, but to keep the balls on the site, on the courts. And one of the things that we can do, and I'll get to the rest of the thing in a minute, I made the area outside here kind of a decomposed granite color, because this would be really neat if we could, you know, fix all this up and pave this all and make it all hardscape so it all could be usable for different kinds of uses. But if we have to, and the bids come in high, we have the opportunity here to do the parking lot, the tennis courts, but leave this area out here, decomposed granite, so we can come back at a later time and put in either the concrete or the asphalt. I'm leaving some large areas in the concept open, like here and down in this area, because I think this could be a multi-use space, and with extra space, there's opportunities for extra activities. One area up here, we do need a pass-through for golf carts because this is a little bit wider here. Golf carts need to come through because we're moving the driving range from this location here, 85 feet down the range to this location here. So we would have golf carts coming in. We need to have space for them to turn around. We could also have benches with shade, umbrella shades, and things like that along here. These two pink things here are buildings that I've just thrown in here because, one, we need to have a building that where the ball dispenser is for the driving range, and then some storage for equipment, things like that. Eventually a restroom facility, but for the time being, maybe just porta potties or something, and then storage for pickleball down in this area here. This would require the removal of a few posts. In this drawing, it would be two posts on this side and just one post on this side. Now, I'm gonna skip to the next slide really quick, but we'll have a chance to talk about all of this. So this is the driving range.
Those are netting posts.
Yeah, those are netting posts. Sorry, those are the telephone poles that hold up the netting. So we would be removing the netting, this post, and this post, and the netting up to the next post, which is there and there. Now, one of the things about moving down here, this is a great location, as I pointed out in the staff report, consistency with the neighborhood or avoiding inconsistencies with the neighborhood and things like that. This is a great location for a number of reasons. But in doing that, we can't really take the existing driving range and compromise it. So what we're proposing is to move the driving range as far down and extend the netting down in this area as much as we are taking away from up here. And this looks like a little bit more, but it's actually about 85 feet is what we're looking at. So that we're not compromising on the driving range by putting the pickleball courts in, because we don't want the people going to the driving range passing all the pickleballers and being mad at them all the time because their driving range got shorter because of the pickleball courts. So we want to do that, and that would be an addition of up to four new posts down here. It could, depending on the distance, it could be anywhere from two new posts at the corners here to four new posts down at the end. And these are the telephone poles and new netting down here at the end. Now, if you superimpose on that the concept for the pickleball courts, this is what you end up getting, is this facility here. So you've got the pickleball courts, the road coming in and out of the golf course, pickleball courts, parking area, service road, and then the driving range starts right in here. And this is the how it all looks together. So I was going to go back up to this thing here. So yeah, any questions on that?
What about the other slide?
Okay.
Normally, this was kind of set up this way before. I mean, normally if you start from, you know, kind of a point and you're, you know, like a baseball field, mm-hmm. you start at home plate, you hit from home plate, and it spreads this way. Whereas what this is doing is it's wider where you're hitting from, and then it gets narrower. Are the golfers okay with that?
The golfers need to get better, so we're going to narrow it down. We're going to narrow it down for their benefit, actually.
So that's the current location of the net. And the reason why it's wider at the one end is because then you can accommodate more golfers.
Yeah, I understand that.
Okay.
But it's just, the golfing, at least the staff golfers have signed off on this.
Yeah, they have, and it does narrow. You can see it narrows as it is.
That's what I mean is, yeah. It currently is that configuration.
Yeah. I understand, but what's happening is it's narrowing more because it's
going out farther, yeah.
The further out it goes, the narrower it gets. I just was questioning whether that was an issue or not.
I don't think it is an issue, and there's no solution either. By fanning it out down here, it wouldn't do anything for the driving range. If anything, you'd have to start up here and fan it out. But that's not the point. The point is accuracy in golf, right? And the point is hitting where you're supposed to hit it, not where you just want to hit it. So out here, they have some targets and things like that that they're aiming for in distances. And they're going for accuracy. So I do think that this is appropriate for the golfers.
Thank you.
And in fact, Patrick has confirmed that it is. But this is where we'd be teeing off from. I'm going to go back up to this slide because there's a lot of details still to be worked out. Again, I want to emphasize that although I'm showing you tonight a concept that we are currently working on, there's still things to be worked out. We're not approving the plan tonight. We just need to get ahead on the funding so that we don't miss the boat on the revenue bond. But I do feel comfortable that with some of the options that we have for this, like doing, not paving all of this all at once, but making sure the pickleball courts are up to standard and playable, we can save a little bit of money. Now, lighting is another thing that people have brought up, and we're going to have a line item of items that we get with the bid. And when we go out to bid, we're going to have them bid all the different line items. And there's going to be a cutoff point where we're like, okay, our money ran out here, and we're not going to be able to do these last two or three or six or whatever it is. And one of those is probably going to be lighting. Lighting is one of the things that would be nice to have. Eventually, you know, I'm sure it could happen, but really what we need to do is get six pickleball courts in that are playable and move the driving range so that the people who use the driving range aren't disproportionately disadvantaged from this pickleball facility. So anyways, I'm proposing that we, just to go back to the proposal, I'm proposing that we add $300,000 to the revenue bond, which would be $150,000 additional for pickleball and $150,000 total for tennis courts. So that's my recommendation.
Okay. Clarification. Are we under the assumption that resurfacing Hunter Park is going to cost $150,000?
Well, yeah. We don't want to just go in and resurface Hunter Park. We want to go in and do as much work as we can to fortify what infrastructure we already have there so that we don't just spend $100,000 to resurface it and then in a couple of years be in the same position that we're in now.
Well, I heard about the cracks.
Yeah.
And I think that's a good idea to secure that the cracks don't repeat and such. But I as a tennis player, I haven't heard anybody complaining about the courts aside from the surface, that the structure is pretty solid.
Okay, I know where you're going with this because you and I had a conversation earlier. I think I know where you're going with this anyways. I would also like to have a cushion in there because if we're going in and doing a major improvement to eight tennis courts, one of those is actually multi-use. I'd like to be able to go in there and do the improvements that we've maybe been holding off on. Yes, we did put up the new plywood wall that's in between the two sides of tennis courts, but there was fencing that we wanted to replace during the project when we did the plywood that we didn't replace. There are things with the multi-use court that we would like to do, including adding more lines, more fencing, more consistent fencing for bike polo, the opportunity for futsal, and potentially some other uses as well. So while we're doing this big project at Hunter Park, I'd really like to get in there and do it right. And what I'm asking for is the funds to be able to get in there and make that project really nice. Not just address what the most immediate issue is, but look down the road a little bit at the things that might be failing in the next 5 to 10 years and try to address those right now as well. So that's why I'd like to say $150,000 for Hunter. Get the bids, make sure we can do everything we're hoping to do, and then look at Lithia Park after that, or look at another funding source for Lithia Park.
So in terms of decision-making about that $150,000 for tennis courts, I and a lot of other people believe that the resurfacing of Lithia should be up there with the concerns for Hunter. And I just don't want to, you know, not leave money for Lithia and redo things that, in my opinion, as a tennis player, aren't that important at 100%.
So as parks director, I'm recommending that we go this route because a couple of things. It's not all about equity, but in this situation, we can be equitable if we're building dedicated facilities for pickleball to take care of a concern that tennis people have had for a very long time. At Hunter Park. That's where we hear the concerns is from Hunter Park for tennis. I know that Lithia Park needs some work and we might be able to do that a different way, but I'm telling you that priority wise, I think we need to focus on Hunter Park. I know that Lithia Park has pickleball use right now and everything, and that might be, it's a big use at Lithia Park, but we're moving a lot of that use hopefully down to the new pickleball facilities. And aside from that, aside from all of that, and saying that, well, this is what my recommendation is, and trying to say my recommendation is right, I've given you an option where if you do think that Lithia Park needs to be done at the same time, just tell me what you'd like me to do, and I'll move forward with it.
Great.
Well, I think I need more information before I can make that kind of decision. And the information I would need is from staff is the condition of Lithia Park courts compared to Hunter Park courts.
Yeah, and we can provide that. And there's not a lot of difference. I can tell you right now, they're just as bad. But we have 8 courts, which is a larger impact if we are to take care of those than the 2 courts at Lithia Park. And that's why we're focusing down at Hunter Park right now.
But you're also saying that that there's a cost savings of doing it all at the same time.
There is, and I've given you an option for where we can do it all at the same time. So.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah, we will. Are you done?
Well, you asked for perspective on the dynamics of this. I just want to address briefly that a couple of the reasons that Michael has referred to about that are beneficial for the current site is the sound impact on neighbors is nil at the new site. And also, I think lighting will not be a problem in terms of bothering anybody down in that little part of the valley. So that's another nice advantage, so that we won't have complaints about, you know, people playing late in the evening. Also, with the way it's currently designed and putting the decomposed granite in, if there isn't the money initially for funding the lighting, it won't be that big a deal to run lines through decomposed granite as opposed to paving it all and then trying to tear it all up again. So those are some of the benefits to this current. So,
and Jim and Julian. Go ahead, Jim and Julian. Go ahead.
I think Michael's point about dedicated course, we heard everybody loud and clear about maybe we want some dedicated pickleball course, and this 325,000 represents that. So it's like the old movie, he built it, and I'm hopeful that they will come. You know, okay, good, because you know, there's issues with Lithia. I can understand how Lithia Park is a really wonderful venue, you know, and I've seen the action go on there, and it works really well. But here, dedicated courts, seems like... please come play on these courts.
Oh, well, I don't
yeah, I could.
I don't think I'm going to be reassured of that.
Sorry. Julie?
So, I'm sorry for coming next to me. Yeah. I'm assuming that the pickleball courts, the tennis courts, and the pool are the best developed kind of projects that are kind of ready to go prior to the point at which the bond is likely to be written and dealt with.
Yeah. Can I respond to that?
Yeah. Okay.
So, yes, you are correct. We are designing the pool. We've done a lot of work on design for the pool, and we're moving forward on that. And we have food and beverage funds that are helping us to do that. So yes, that one's a yes for sure. The pickleball, I think, is in the same boat. We've been gearing up, you know, doing surveys and getting an engineer on board, and we're ready to go forward once the plans are finished, which could be in the next, well, hopefully by the first of the year, we'll have some plans and be bidding soon after that, so it'll be a spring summer project. And then the tennis courts, we can schedule those anytime. There's really not a lot of design that goes into that. So
that's something like Zero East Main, like working on that project that hasn't been fleshed out enough, or
no, it hasn't been fleshed out enough. We're not at a point. We do have money dedicated for that, but we're also not at a point where we could actually start building that just yet. We just got a planner on board to do the annexation. We just did our first public meeting, and we haven't even started with the concept yet. So we're still a bit away from actually doing work at East Main.
Thanks.
Did you want to say anything?
Well, I just want to say, let's try to just stay with questions now. And because we've kind of gotten into discussion and wait till after public input.
So, and we'll have public input in just a moment. So, I had a question on the slide that you had. This slide.
Okay, I'll go back to that. Which matrix? The first one with just the pool, or
no,
the second?
No, the second one.
Okay.
So, but one of your previous slides showed the things we were going to do in 2020, but we're not going to draw on that bond, or we will be able to draw on the bond in 2020, but we won't have to make our first installment until 2021. Is that what you're saying?
That's right. So we still have work to do to get the pool up and ready to go, and to do bid documents and all those things for the pool and for the pickleball. So what I'm hoping is that we are awarded the bond and draw on it in 2020 and start paying on it in 2021. And that's just how it worked with the last revenue bond that we did as well.
So. And are you confident that it'll work that way?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I am.
Great. Okay, well then, we have two folks that want to speak on the revenue bond. I have Ken Crocker and Jack. You guys can both come up and you'll have 4 minutes to speak.
You can go ahead.
What's that?
You can go ahead.
Hi, I'm Ken Crocker. I live at 134 Nutley Street, International. Been playing pickleball probably about 12 years. I'm sponsored by one of the main companies that manufacture pickleball equipment. And I've had the opportunity to play both in tournaments and recreationally a number of different places around the country. And I just wanted to say, from my experience of seeing pickleball venues in other communities, I'm in no way worried that the six courts will not get used. My concern is that six courts won't be enough. The sport is absolutely exploding. And I constantly have people come up to me, ask about it, say, I've heard about it, they see us play, they want to learn how to play. People come from out of town and drop in and play with the groups that play in the apartment. I'm guessing most of your emphasis is on serving citizens of Ashland in terms of parks design. But I wanted to add that pickleball is something that people from out of town, from the Rogue Valley region, even from out of town, who come to the Shakespeare Festival and for other things, good pickleball facilities will draw people to our community and bring money to our local businesses. I think I've traveled to Bend probably 5 times to play pickleball, playing tournaments there, and seeing hundreds of people that come with their families and spend lots of money in that community. That's just one example. And they have a wonderful pickleball facility there. And I also wanted to urge Lithia Park. I think it's a crown jewel. I don't think those courts are going to become second-hand courts when we have these 6 new ones. I think both venues are going to be important centers of pickleball. And I hope that there's a way to maintain and resurface those courts also. Because they're in the heart of Ashland. They're in Lithia Park. People are going to want to play there too. And those courts won't have the capacity for the demand that we're seeing. So, thank you.
Okay, thank you. Right,
Jack the Thought, Southern Oregon Pickleball Association president. A few items. First of all, we're glad that y'all are looking at this site. We are very much in favor of the location there as opposed to up on top here for a lot of reasons. And I think they were all iterated here earlier. So thank you for that. Secondly, to help if we can. We know that the Parks and Rec can have volunteers. We see the kids out there all the time in the summertime. But we have a lot of retired people from the trades that have a pretty good working knowledge of how to build things. So if you want to help, if you want help with the costs, then let us help. We can help bring the cost down with our volunteer work. We've also had estimates for cost because we've made presentations to other cities and towns here. And Michael's, as far as we're concerned, that's, Michael, we're seeing the same thing you are. So we think that you're pretty well right on. And lastly, as an update, and to back up what Ken just said, we just passed, SOPA has just passed the 600 mark of the people in SOPA. 600. So we started 2 years ago in October with about 175.
Okay. Great. Thanks a lot. Okay. I'll close the public portion of the meeting, public hearing portion, and we can go to commissioner discussion on revenue bond. Anybody have anything to say? Well, does Rick want to make a motion?
Well,
yes.
I'm prepared to make a motion to allow the discussion to go forward. I move to approve the addition of $300,000 for the open old pickleball courts and resurfacing of the Hunter Park courts be added to the approved pool revenue bond for a new total of $2,900,000.
Okay, do you have a second? Okay, we have a motion and a second. Discussion. We'll start with you, Joel, since you made the motion.
Well, as you folks know, I've been pushing this. I was actually remembering today when I first time I met with the two of you as a new incoming commissioner. You were asking me about my agenda, and I made the comment that I would really like to see dedicated pickleball courts. And the comment at that point was, well, that should cost a whole lot less than a pool, and that should be very doable for us. So I'm 3 years in now. I'm hoping that we can, as Ken Crocker was saying, the sport is exploding. You know, we're not ahead of the curve, but we're hopefully meeting a need that I think there'll be very few, frankly, very few recreation facilities, with the exception of Lithia Park itself, that will get more usage than our pickleball courts. Just, it's what I've seen everywhere I go, that the courts are utilized multiple hours. I do hope that we can get lighting on, because I know people would be out there tonight. People are driving to Central Point because that's the only place we have lit courts. So I hope that we'll be able to work that in. And I know that SOPA will be willing to help do some fundraising for things like that if we're short on that. But it's... And I also know that on our agenda today is, you know, becoming an age-friendly group to be recognized as such. And I don't know what the statistics are, but my sense is 60 is about the medium age for pickleball players. And talking about having recreation facilities for all ages and being supportive of our seniors, I think this ties right into that.
Great. Yep.
I'm going to support this because I'm sure as everybody else knows, in our goal setting, these were fairly high on the list, the pool especially, and the pickleball courts kept rising to the top, and then the tennis courts. If you have facilities, we should maintain them in an acceptable manner, and I think our director came up with a non-political or less political decision to finance this and show the community that this prepared food and beverage tax comes right back to the community in a big way, and I think we have justified that and shown all the important things that we've done for the community with this money. So I thank people all the time for eating out and paying this tax because I've seen what it's done in the theory and practice. It's really a valuable thing. So I'm really excited that there's talk, there's theory, there's hopes, and then there's fruition. I mean, we're right on the edge of actually getting dedicated pickleball courts and getting an improved pool. And so the talk's over, and now it's going to be exciting to actually build these things for the community. So, yeah, I would support it.
Great, thanks. Rick?
Well, a few things I want to talk about. But to begin with, I wanted to say, I think that, to me, I'm just wondering why we wouldn't just put the $25,000 into this for Lithia Park. Just to me, it seems like if we're doing this, why not just do it, you know, just do it all, and if we don't have it in here, then it's really easy to say, oh, we're running out of money and we're not going to do it. But if we actually put that $25,000 destined for Lithia Park renovation work for the tennis courts, pickleball courts there, then I'd have more confidence it's going to get done. And so I just don't, if we want to do it, I think it should be in the...
Do you want to make a friendly amendment?
It'll round it up to a nice number. So
it will.
The bond.
No, it's 29.25.
Oh, that's right. It's the the total price will end up being 3.1.
For all the projects.
Yeah, for all the projects.
Right. Can I just add something?
I'd love to hear it.
Well, one thing just about the Lithia Park courts, I think Michael already gave us an option to do those if, in fact, the $150 is entirely spent at Hunter Park. So I don't see an urgency to increase the bond amount to cover that potential need, because we've already identified another funding source that we could use for that. If, in fact, we get to that point and we realize with the bids that the entire $150 is going to have to be used at Hunter Park. So I'm not that wild about increasing the bond number. I mean, we had a bond number. We've increased it. I'm not really... Because we have another option. I'm not really in favor of increasing it that much more.
You're talking about the apartment issue.
Right. But just so I won't talk again, I'm definitely in favor of the bond measure, and we'll vote for it because it really identifies three major user groups in town that I think will benefit immensely from these projects. So I definitely want to have the money available, and I want to hit that schedule of 2020 starting these projects again. So I kind of diverted from that, but go ahead.
Thank you. So with what was projected in the presentation, staff presentation, did it say Hunter Park tennis courts or did it say tennis courts?
Hunter Park. In the staff report, it says Hunter Park.
In the motion.
Yeah. And it doesn't refer to Lithia Park in the staff report.
So I think we can, yeah. Well, we have a motion.
Julie, did you want to add anything?
Well, no. I think the work that most of you all have done to put this together is really tremendous, and you've done it. And I'm really impressed that we've gone this far, and now we're about to have all these great public facilities with the money for the public service, so that's all phenomenal. I was going to ask you some more about the plans for heating the pool and whether that would actually save money on the pool going forward in the future. But it seems like that's kind of a different conversation that we're having at the moment.
It is. I'll just say that I've already, in the what I presented to you last month, I've already anticipated some savings in natural gas. So.
Please come on.
Well, just these are kind of a little bit peripheral, but I wanted to point out that we are going to very soon have a we'll have designated revenue needs and need of revenue source for Lithia Park improvements. We're not there yet, but we will have that. And just that's just perspective. We'll detail, look at all that DG, like that's a cost saving. All that DG, when I look at that, that just says equals more herbicide use. Because the golf course, there is an exception, and we're using herbicides on the granite pathways, and I assume it's going to come back to that. So, because this is, it's one thing to have DG pathways, because one, they're tromped on, and number two, they don't have to be perfect. But I think right around these brand new pickleball courts, people aren't going to like a lot of weeds. And I just wonder, you know, who's thinking about that? I'll just get my third point out, and if Seth wants to talk to you, I can. I also want to say that for our organization, traditionally, when sports supporters have wanted lights, our tradition is that, that those organizations have helped pay for them. And I think that's a good tradition.
Can I comment?
Yep, sure.
I think it's a great tradition. I think it's harder for responding to one of the comments. It's harder for us to take people who know the trades and get them to help build something, because we generally contract an entire build out to a contractor who has insurance and all those types of things. But money always means something, and putting money towards lighting would be a great focus for the group. But as far as the DG goes, that's a fallback. That is if we can't get the whole plan, and I'll present this to you again, but if we have to compromise because of funding, because we end up moving the, you know, we got a lot of stuff to do out there, and we end up not quite having enough in the end, I think the DG is thrown out there as a compromise to make sure that we get everything in. And so in saying that, I'm also trying to emphasize that it would be temporary, that we'd have to come back at some point and look at something like more asphalt or concrete in there to make that hard surface and to make it more usable.
Yep.
If we add a little extra for that crystal ball you were talking about, then we could solve all kinds of problems, really. So we might consider that.
Yeah. Yeah, give me one of those. That'd be great.
Okay. We have a motion. We have a second. We've had discussion. Take a roll call vote.
Commissioner Lott?
Yes.
Commissioner Bell?
Yes.
Commissioner Lewis?
Yes.
Commissioner Heller?
I'm allowed to resound the
Commissioner Gardner?
Yes.
Motion passes.
Thank you.
Can I make...
Thank you.
Can I just make a comment really quick?
Yeah.
The emphasis is going to be on the Hunter Park courts. That doesn't mean that the Lithia Park courts are getting forgotten about. It's just, my point is that I think we need to finish Hunter Park courts before we do Lithia Park courts. But I will be working to try to get both of those included, because they both, as a maintenance item, they both need to be done. And so when you see those contracts come back, hopefully Lithia Park will be part of that.
Okay. Excellent. Let's move on to our next item on unfinished business, which is Memorial's policy discussion. And we'll turn it over to Sean Sullivan.
I'm going to interrupt real quick.
Okay.
All right.
I'm going to turn it over to Mike Austin.
So I just wanted to formally acknowledge all the work that Sean's put into this, behind the scenes and also out in the field. And without all his dedication and work to this, it wouldn't have gotten done to the level that it's at right now. And I really appreciate him stepping forward and doing that. And it's kind of above and beyond what he needed to do for that. And it's really helped me out a lot in taking that off of my plate. He's also the front face of APRC up in the administration building. He takes most of the phone calls for these types of things. And it's really helpful when he has such a thorough background of this to be able to air those phone calls and deal with the people that are requesting these memorials. And I like to move in when it's more, where are these memorials going to go? How are we going to install them? How are we going to maintain them? That's a critical part of it. And we've made a really good team, I feel like, going through. But Sean's done a ton of research. He's talked to other parks departments. He's looked at other people's policies. He's gone out in the field and literally GIS'd every memorial that we have in parks, looked at the condition of those memorials, reported it back to staff, and done a real bang-up job of letting us know where we're lacking in funds and where we're lacking in the ability to keep some of these memorials up to date. And been a great sounding board. And so I'd like to turn it over to you.
Thank you very much. Quick note, when I was moving a table into the building, I found another memorial unknown on the back of the grove. So I'm going to take a picture of that after the meeting. At the September study session, we presented on this and got your feedback and went back and made some changes to that policy. The policy at the commission's direction no longer refers to signs. It's strictly a memorials policy. The process for non-standard memorials clearly states that the subcommittee charged with reviewing will make a recommendation, who will then send it to the full commission to make approval for those non-standard memorials. Costs have been identified to cover the full cost of installing the memorial as well as maintenance for the memorial itself and general parks maintenance, just maintenance that needs to happen in parks. It's cleaned up some language about referencing the administrative procedures documents, and then also removed mention of the endowment from the foundation. One has not been created, and so if one were to be created, that would be under the direction of the board of the Parks Foundation. So we struck that out of the policy itself. Staff was directed to reach out to other jurisdictions to kind of see what they are doing. And so I reached out to Portland, Lake Oswego, Bend, Walla Walla, Estes Valley Recreation District, and also took a look at Rocky Mountain Conservancy. It was a mixed bag as to whether or not the memorials were dedicated for a set period of time or for the life of the item itself. It seemed like a lot of the jurisdictions where they were installing steel only had life of the item or at least 20 years, and in areas where the benches were wood, they were putting a time frame on them, 5 to 10 years, and turning those over. The prices that are currently outlined in the administrative document are kind of in line with what's going on elsewhere. And we are moving in the direction that a lot of these folks have in place of making sure that memorials that are placed follow a set guidelines so we have a uniform look and can reduce maintenance costs long term using the same types of materials. And at least one, Estes Valley Recreation District is actually getting ready to move. They're trying to move away from memorializing items, and they want to go to a memorial wall only. That's just a summary of the feedback that, or the information I got back from other jurisdictions. And so we would like to, so we made the changes in the document and want to hear back from the commission on this, and are planning to present next week at the regular business meeting.
Question for Sean.
Sean, are you? How often are you getting requests for memorials these days?
So I've been with Parks and Rec since February, and I've got about 6 or 7 people lined up. So they come in like roughly every other month. Yeah. So I would assume like 6 to 10 a year.
What's your lot?
I'm looking at Roman numeral 8, the section on page 5, bottom of 5 and top of 6.
Removal, replacement, and expiration?
After a period of 10 years that required. Last paragraph on.
Yes.
So what happens if the 10-year period's over and the whatever's being memorialized is still in great shape?
It's a policy decision. I mean, I think if we go at 10 years, regardless of the state that it's in, that's what they paid for, and that's what they're getting is 10 years. It's not conditioned on weather or something like that.
So, if I can follow up, then the opportunity to rededicate memorial by donating the amount identified by existing memorials in the standard, that would then, they would need to pay basically, if it's a bench, whatever that cost is, they'd have to pay it.
They would get essentially the first right of refusal. And there's the way that the costs are set up now is that there's a cost for installing a new item, and then there's the cost of securing a memorial on an existing item is less than that. So let's say if it's a wood bench, they're not paying for all new materials. That bench can be spruced up a bit.
So what is the cost difference?
Let's see. So for wood benches, a new wood bench is $1,000. And existing wood is $750, and that's actually quite affordable when looking at comparing it to other jurisdictions. When you look at steel, it's $3,400 for a new bench and $2,550 for an existing.
For existing, so after 10 years, see, that's why I just wondered. It seems a little odd that after 10 years, I've donated this bench. I paid $3,400 for it. 10 years down the line, it's still in great shape. And I get a call saying, well, you're going to pay $2,000 more. You can keep your plaque on that. Otherwise, we're taking your plaque off.
Well, that is the contract that they agreed to.
Yeah. Again. And Ashland Parks and Recreation needs to have an incentive to do it as well. So it's not just about getting a new bench in a park. It's about helping Ashland Parks and Recreation long-term financially as well. And I think, Sean, correct me if I'm wrong, but the expiration of 10 years is pretty standard. It's not something we cooked up, is it?
Portland goes with 10 years. A handful of other jurisdictions go with 10 years. Yeah.
And do they do this similar kind of thing where after 10 years?
Yeah, so in other policies, and one of them is even spelled out that it's that the donor after 10 years needs to reach out, and if they don't reach out, then it automatically gets expired, but that information is all relayed up front at the beginning.
Thank you for that clarification.
Mike?
To me, this also struck another chord was that at some point, Lithia Park will be full. We won't have any more locations for potential benches. And so the 10-year expiration date also encourages us to be able to memorialize more people in a small location that has just a number. So if every bench expires in 10 years, you can choose to keep it going indefinitely, as long as you can continue to pay for the maintenance of that bench moving forward, or we get the opportunity to let somebody else memorialize their loved one. And maybe 10 years is all, you know, that family really wanted to put forward anyways.
Question what?
I had two other points. One was in Roman numeral 2D. And I actually, that language was there before. It's not a change in language. And I don't have any problem with the language in particular. But I think it's, we're missing out on we're not considering one of the possibility. Oftentimes, it would be particularly the cost of developing a park to be as expensive as purchasing the land for the park. And there isn't any mechanism. So, for example, right now we already own East Main.
Yeah.
But someone could come along now and say, hey, I'll give you $1 million to develop it. Can I get my name on it? And we don't have a way of dealing with that. And I would like to see us have that possibility.
I think we can amend that one before we come back.
I'd
also like to quantify what major portion means. Because...
More than half. And then on Roman numeral 5B, I think it's not like shit has been changed, but I just don't get the sentence that says, or the two sentences. It says, plaques made of permanent materials such as bronze or other metals or stone, period. And it says, next sentence says, may be mounted in walls and gate or on cast concrete. So again, that was apparently language that's always been there, but do you please correct that?
Yeah, that's periods in the wrong place. It's always been in the wrong place.
Yeah. Okay, so I've done my editorship thing.
So
I've done.
Are you missing?
So where was the...
So any other questions? This will be coming back to us later in the month. For action, so this is just information today. Seeing none.
Well, I might have one other thing.
Right here.
B. Okay. So I want to point this out to make sure everybody's okay with this because this is 4B, not B4. But it's 4B.
Page 4? No,
that's page 3.
Yeah, okay.
Okay, so the second sentence says, donors are encouraged to wait 1 year after the loss of the person being memorialized before submitting an application. The policy's always been you had to wait. And I threw this in here because I thought it would be good to discuss this to see where the commissioners want to go with this. Do you want it to be a guideline or do you want it to be a rule that they have to wait a year or just a guideline? It'd be good to wait a year. I think.
Go ahead.
What is the rationale for having it either way?
Well, I can tell you the rationale for having it be a guideline.
No, that's not my question.
Yeah.
My question is there's two options. The way it was before was you had to wait a year. Now staff is suggesting that it be encouraged but not be required. So my question is, why is there anything in there about waiting a year at all?
Well, there was.
Because that's what was
still
it. That was the policy.
Why is my question?
But what I'm... Okay, so where we're coming from is... we'd like to start a discussion about maybe backing that up a little bit. We're not here to defend why it was there before, because I don't know. Maybe Mike has a comment that will bring more light to it, but I'm saying I don't think it's necessary to have a hard guideline, but you may think differently.
Jim and I were probably both around when we originally did that.
Wrote a lot of this original text. An anecdotal story is we've already had one family who immediately went to the council because they weren't interested in waiting a year. So I think Rick's question is, the key is, if there's a good, solid, defendable reason why we have it in there, then we should question that. If not, if we think we should have some wording in there, let's make the guideline. I mean, guideline gives us discretion. And we can, we, you know, when there's an insistent family, So,
but my point is, why?
Yeah.
Why even have it at all?
That's a good point.
Unless there, I want to hear a reason. If there's a reason for waiting here, then I'm okay. But if there's no reason,
I
cut it out.
Having Julian answer that, please.
Oh, yeah, cut it out. I agree.
Yeah. Well, Joel, as a son of a clergyman, many people would speak to the fact that people are not thinking as clearly and they're in a very emotional place during the initial time just after their passing, so there might be more clarity and more rational about it than in the short run. I'm not defending it, but
right. And I think that was probably more the reason why it was in there.
I had a conversation with Susan when I first started here, who was helping with the Science Blacks Memorials Committee at that point, and she had told me that some of the background on it was because staff had dealt with some very emotionally charged instances where people got very demanding and very irate when things weren't moving fast enough for them and for the ceremonies that they were planning directly around the either burial ceremonies or memorial services. They wanted to somehow couple a memorial in the park with a ceremony. And as we all know, things through governmental process can take a little bit longer than what people expect. And so I think the idea behind the year is to let, for two reasons, let people calm down a little bit emotionally and let some of that that abruptness settle. And two, also for their own judgment of making decisions based off of spending money to memorialize somebody. When somebody first dies, it probably seems like that's a really good idea, and after having time to think about it, maybe they're less inclined to do that in the future or less inclined.
So I have to comment on that because I think it's just as bad to deal with somebody who comes in and wants to memorialize their son who was just murdered close to Lithia Park, who's being told that they can't, in dealing with that situation, as it is to have to tell some, you know, to deal with timelines and things like that. I'm going to recommend that the commissioners strike this because, frankly, we violated this in the last couple of years. I think it ended up taking longer than a year anyways to do the whole thing because of the family, but this did come up and we actually were like, gosh, can't think of a good reason to make you wait a year. And I don't want the staff to be on either side of that. I think we should have guidelines that are non-biased. People can come in and we can do things as quick as we can do things. And so I just say strike the whole thing.
You wouldn't even leave, encourage him to wait a year?
No.
I mean that leaves it totally optional.
Why would anybody?
Well, okay. If people want to be generous towards the park, it seems to me, and memorialize their relative, that we should not put an area in the way. Right, exactly. I mean, you know, they want to support the park, they have a very beneficent impulse, and they want to memorialize them. Great. Right.
So, just tonight then, because this is your, right? Mm-hmm. Your recommendation and you're changing you're proposing changing it or is this really what changed?
Well, I wanted to bring it up because I do think we need to change it, and I'm leaning towards recommending that we just we take this out because it if it's just encouraging somebody to do something, it doesn't need to be in a codified policy.
If they're emotionally distraught, are they going to listen to the fact that they're encouraged?
And let's also own up to, we're talking about plaques on benches, you know, and why do we as staff need to get involved in the backstory of why someone's being memorialized? It's, if somebody wants to be if they want to memorialize a family member, we shouldn't have qualifications like this. If they can follow the guidelines and pay the amount that's paid, we shouldn't. I don't think that we should be getting involved in who is getting memorialized unless it violates some sort of other policy. That's what I think.
So are you proposing that we strike just a portion of B, or
just from donors? We'll work on it and get it back to you the way that we think it should be.
Well, we could just take a straw poll if that's what we want.
I think coming back with the I just didn't see it struck. I think that there, I mean, not that there wasn't valid reason. I hear the valid reasons, but I think it's just cleaner just not to have it in there. And I would leave it to staff to.
Okay, well, that's two of you. Do you have a preference?
Three.
Okay. Yeah, I would just.
Okay.
Amend it.
We will take care of that. Thank you.
Did you want to say something?
I just want to make a comment to chime in with Mike's. Sean, this is a better document because of you, and I must say it's very comprehensive, and we've sweated out so many little details, and you come back and the whole GPSing and showing the inventory and potentials, and us not having to, you can memorialize people and not lose any funding, you know, it's not costing us to memorialize, and so I think this really is a much better policy. And it's like all policies, they're constantly being reviewed and changed by time. But hey, this is a great update, I think.
I would agree with that as well, Sean.
Anything else to add to this discussion? You're good? Okay, thank you very much, Mike, Sean, and Michael. So we'll move on to our last item on unfinished business, which is the ever rolling on but Trails Master Plan discussion.
Oh, is it time for that already?
Did you update the Trails Master Plan?
Yeah. So I'm not, this is an information item. As you know, I've presented this to you before. I presented this to the Planning Commission, the Transportation Commission, and this document is a result of a lot of community work that went into amending a document that already existed. So a lot of the work in here, a lot of the things that you see in here is old information that's just been updated, old language that's been modified a little bit to be more consistent with where we are now. The maps have all been updated, though, to be consistent with what we've done since the last time the master plan was updated, and I'm bringing it to you today because the City Council has resurrected this again, and they'd like to get it on their agenda for January. So we have, there were some changes that when I brought this to you before, we have notes of those changes. I wanted to bring it to you one more time in a work setting so that you could give any more feedback that you might have so that I can bring it back to you. And I'm going to actually recommend that we bring it back in December now, since the City Council has bumped their review of it to January, and that way that gives us a little bit more time to work on a couple of other things that staff is working on, like the pool funding package for December 3rd for the City Council and things like that. So I will just leave it at that, open it up. I've been through this with you before, and I'd just love to hear any feedback that you have on the plan.
Thanks, Joe.
Well, to begin with, I want to clarify something. If there are changes, and let's say the language decreases or increases, what's that going to do to the formatting?
We will take care of the formatting because we have taken this from the designer and we have control over the formatting now. So we'll handle that.
That's kind of a relief.
Yeah. We'll have to delete something. You can't put something in without taking something out. So just,
oh, is that true?
No, I'm just kidding. No, we can work with the format.
I sometimes wish that's the way government works.
Yeah.
I'm voting for you.
That's the way my brain works. So.
So I've had a number of. Oh,
really? We went through every cent of that document.
Well,
over the course of 2 years. And we had, you know, 12 people in a room beating each other up, you know, so, but please.
Well, just as a, the dates in it need to be addressed a bit. It looks to me like the goal was to try to make it so, no matter when it came out, the dates were. But I think it just needs another pass through on that to make it make more sense.
In the dates of completion?
Yeah, just the dates of all kinds of things. And in fact, I don't think it should be called the 2018 document. It's not going to get approved till end of 2019 and beginning of 2020.
Can I comment on that? I think we can change it to the 2020 Trails Master Plan. I mean, I'm sure that sounds horrible for the people who worked on this, but one of the reasons why having the date in the description of the plan, one of the reasons why we do that is so that we always know how old it is and when we need to update it. So if we're talking about the 2020 plan in 2060, you know, we might want to.
Can we call it 2020 vision?
Yeah. No.
I'll demand a little more substantive. I really think there should be some recommendations as to how to accomplish the great vision of the plan. And from my perspective, I'd like to see that work. And according to Director Black, there is sort of, you know, there are some things, you know, and obviously we all could think of ways to accomplish it. But I'd just like to see that actually included in the document. So it becomes a little bit more, on a conceptual basis, it's more prescriptive. So if you read the document and go, okay, that'd be great. And then you can see in the document, this is potential ways to accomplish it.
So, and my comment on that is I don't think we could do that for every place where encouragement is given to do something, but there are places that make a lot of sense, like acquiring easements and properties. We have various ways that we have done that and been successful doing that, and I think we're in a good position to put something in there in that chapter about some of the tools that could be in that toolbox to help to guide that in the future. So other than that, though, I didn't envision going through here and going through every chapter and like trail safety protocols and trying to come up with action items action items for each chapter. Because there are action items in here. But I do, Rick brought that up. Commissioner Long brought that up earlier, and I do agree that we could add something in that acquisition chapter.
In this time frame?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, I don't think it'll slow anything down.
Good question. We got 2020 holding. Certainly have it.
Yeah.
And I'm not getting any younger.
Yeah.
We're going to be dead before it goes forward.
I be careful. I might be dead.
Well,
talking about the Ashland Canal Trail. Mm-hmm. It talks about the part that is owned by the city, talks about the part where the city has easements, but it's silent about the rest of the trail. And I've heard from Director Black in some arguments why you wouldn't want to be real specific or maybe have show it on the map. But it seems to me that to have a fully fleshed out master plan, there should be a section that says part of the, maybe the majority of the trail is on private property without public easement. Of that, and then of that, there's actually two sections. Two different kind of categories. One is a category where it's been blocked off. The other category is where the property owners have allowed access to the property without, even though there's not an easement. And I think that would flesh out that understanding of what's going on in the with that trail. Because it is kind of a unique situation.
My only concern with that when we talked earlier was I didn't want to call out each property one by one because I didn't want to spook anybody who's currently doesn't have an agreement, who currently doesn't have an agreement with us, and they see them, their names or their property address in a plan, that could cause some problems. But just making a statement that, you know, just explaining that there's these different categories, I don't see a problem with that.
I think it's important. I think it helps someone looking at the document who doesn't have the knowledge of the people that wrote it understand what's going on there.
We did try to steer clear of all the non-public owned trails.
I mean, that was the whole
we
idea.
We could all go around the horn and talk about how well used some illegal trails are, but we really, you know, we wanted to be somewhat diplomatic. But I think what you're talking about is the ditch trail might be slightly different than, let's say, Ostrich Peak, which you know is highly used, but.
I think everybody kind of knows this, or a lot of people know the situation. And I think I totally agree that we don't want to be telling people, we don't want people who aren't allowed, we don't want to focus on them, making them the bad guys. We don't want to focus on the people who are allowing, even though there's an easement. But I think just in the document, to make it a paragraph or a statement to flesh out what our situation is to make for a more complete document.
Being cheerleader again, I was on the first group that started the Trails Master Plan first document, and Scott Kurtz volunteered, spent an inordinate amount of time. The community came together. The document that was produced, people were astounded how much value in scribe time this was. And this revision is very similar. You know, people from the community who had a passion for this come in, volunteer their time and effort, and produce a document that just the two editors alone, I thank you over and over again, and I thank them both a couple times. But, you know, it's really, it really is bonding to have community members come in and want to get involved and be proactive about where our community's going. And those two instances, I can speak from experience, that was a pretty, pretty amazing group of people we had volunteered both instances. So. Hopefully the next one will have another one.
Yeah.
You probably won't be on.
My son will be chair.
Yeah. The legacy. It'll be a legacy.
So were there any other comments? I can take comments offline as well. You can send those to me. And any comments will be made and put in there. And hopefully as you go through, you'll look for the red additions. So that you can see if anything was added. So,
great.
Yeah, I just have one more, and that is again, these are all the things that Director Black and I have already discussed. So that's why he's so able to jump with it in the right after that. I bring him up, which is great. It's really touching because what I'm bothered by is something that's already been changed in the document. And that has to do with the coordination when development is about to or potentially going to occur around trail sites or trail segments. And my experience is that the planning commission isn't necessarily thinking about trails when they make their decisions. And in fact, I know they're not. And so anything we do in this document to encourage, coordinate, or whatever the word is with planning department and the commission, planning commission, I think it would be valuable. And so what happened is there is a statement in there about that, but it said shall, and it got changed to should coordinate. And I guess the biggest example of that is the approval on the National Creek property a few years ago, where the Planning Commission went against the recommendations of the staff. Parks didn't know anything about it, and our potential for a trail down National Creek was really that potential was really decreased by that decision. And I don't know what I just hate to see this continue to happen. And if we don't do something differently, I don't know why we'll get different results.
I think the only thing we've changed from the first document to this document is the fact that Parks is part of the pre-application process, which puts us in the loop. We get to see everything that every other department, fire, life safety, public works, historic. We want to be there at the very beginning when there's proposals and conceptual ideas, and then we get to chime in. And the rest is just lobbying. Sometimes the Planning Commission can frustrate people because they go against your personal best interests and stuff. So I think as long as we can get in early and we see something that may be potential red flag, we need to do that. And how it gets injected into this, or is it just now policy that we are now at the table for all the pre-apps? I think we discussed this at one point. When you get these to your desk and you can evaluate and then come to us and say, I see a situation coming up. So,
that puts a lot of pressure on one person. Is it just one person in the department?
No, there's a few, and I think I need to say something here, because putting shall in there puts a lot of pressure on the Planning Commission, and I don't think the Planning Commission necessarily, and we did talk about this earlier, but I don't know that even if we were able to get shall in there, that there it just automatically just pops up every time they're making a decision about trails. I think part of that is having different divisions in a city and different people responsible for different things is you have to have your champions for all of these different things. One group, one planning commission can't be the champion for everything. That's why they need to get reports through the pre-app process, and staff needs to be able to write a report that covers all of these different areas. So I go back to putting shall in there. I'm not sure that it's going to make any difference, and I do think it's more incumbent on us as staff than it is on the Planning Commission to make sure trails gets brought up. I mean, they've got a lot of other ordinances that they have to worry about and state statutes that they have to worry about, and they're lay people. But we're here we're professionals doing a job. I think that's part of our responsibility.
Other things regarding the Trails Master Plan?
I'm through my list. Thank you.
Anybody else have a list?
The 12 people who created it.
Okay, so you've got a couple changes.
Yeah.
We're not going with this to council until January.
That's right.
So,
and just some background on that, Steph Steffinger asked for it to be pushed off until January so she could be here for the meeting, which I think is a good thing.
Yeah. Okay, then we'll, but you're going to bring this back to us
in December, right? In December, okay, so for a business meeting. Right. So you'll see this and be able to make a motion for approval on it in December. Hopefully you'll approve it.
Approve it and send it back to the committee.
Yeah. Approve it some way. Anyway, just approve it. And I'm going to ask that we do number two first down here instead of one.
Sure. So we'll move on to new business, and we'll flip-flop the age-friendly community application. So we'll start with number two. And Eileen and Sandy can come up.
Good evening, commissioners.
I'm Sandy Tyson. I'm chair of the National Senior Advisory Committee.
And since this project is very much driven by the National Senior Advisory Committee, Sandy, if you could come present it so you can understand what's coming from the committee.
So you have background materials on this, so I'm not going to repeat everything. Essentially, what we're asking you to do is that the Parks Commission, mainly Michael Gardner, signed the application along with the mayor so that the application for becoming an age-friendly city comes from both organizations. We feel that that this whole initiative needs to be from, essentially, from the whole city. It's not just from the city council, it's not just from Parks, and it's not just from the Ashland Senior Advisory Committee. We feel that it's really the whole thing. Just as a bit of background, we did submit a letter of intent a few months ago that was signed by the mayor, and that was accepted, and they invited us, they meaning the AARP, age-friendly group, invited us to submit an application, and you have a copy of that application, which is what we would like to be co-signed. You have information about what being age-friendly means, and I'm not going to go over all that. I'm entertain questions about it. Essentially, what it is we're already well on our way to being an age-friendly community. You mentioned the pickleball and the age 60, and that's part of it. And we can cite many ways in which we as a community are being age-friendly. What this status would do for us, I believe, is to maybe push that a little further, but also put us in a network of age-friendly communities across the state and across the country where we can learn best practices, we can get information, we can give them information. Without any cost, it doesn't cost us anything to belong to this group. We can benefit from the experience that other people have had. The city, as you may know, has as one of their initiatives being all age friendly, and we are really looking at all age friendly, not just senior friendly. We feel that it's kind of counterproductive not to be all age friendly, because we know that people have parents, have children. It just we don't feel that it's a good thing to pit younger against older, and this would not do that. So I don't know. Do you want to add anything, Eileen, or I want to open it to time for questions?
Maybe I'll just briefly describe a little bit about my age.
Okay.
For those that haven't perhaps had time to study it in more depth, age-friendly communities as the network that's created by AARP really is building on a larger concept of livable communities. And so that's part, even though AARP is a champion for it, it's connecting to things that have been in the public works realm and city planning realms for a long time. that their argument is that the things that work for seniors also work for all people in a community. It's supportive for the same curb cut that helps someone with a disability is helpful for someone who is aging and finds it difficult to walk the steps. And it's also helpful for the parent with a stroller and a stroller and a toddler to follow behind to navigate those curbs. Good lighting on a street is helpful for a variety of ages. Benches in appropriate places can be helpful for all kinds of people. So the goal is to make a more livable, congenial place to live in general, and to thereby serve a variety of populations. I will call your attention to, in your handout, there was an attachment right after the application that has this little graphic on it, and it shows the domains. And I think it's worth calling your attention to that, because one domain is outdoor spaces and buildings. Well, obviously, your commission has a lot to do with many outdoor spaces, but not all. Transportation and housing are two other commissions in our city. And so on, social participation, respect, and social inclusion, we have some bearing on that in the Senior Services Division. Civic participation and employment, very much citywide, communication and information, community and health services. You can see that these domains are trying to be very comprehensive. They're similar domains to some of the blue cities that work that the chamber and the hospital have been doing. How do we make better spaces in our, a better community overall? But obviously, we're not going to affect all of those just as the Parks Commission, right? The National Parks and Rec Commission. So partnership is a really key factor in this. And I think part of making that application, making that letter of intention in that application, is that the city's embracing that as a city goes forward with its planning, like the Trails Master Plan, like various other master plans the city has, that we pause and consider the needs of different age groups in those plans. Not necessarily to tear the city down and start over and make it age friendly. We've heard some interesting comments about, well, those hills aren't very age friendly. Probably not going to be changed in that. But as we go forward with fixing, maintaining, recreating parts of our city, can we be thoughtful about what will serve the needs of not just the aging and elderly, but a whole variety of our population, and the same in these other domains. And this is an opportunity for you as the commission that made a decision a couple years ago to really change the senior program to the Senior Services Division and really broaden the scope and the intention to say, yes, City Council, we're showing up, we're a partner with you in this. That it is neither just the city's project or the mayor's project, nor just the Parks and Rec. But by putting names together, I think you make a really strong statement about collaborating and sharing.
Can I just add one thing to that? Just at our last meeting, we actually had the mayor and the city administrator show up because there's concern that, of course, the mayor appoints all the commissions, the other transportation, planning, all of those. And, the concern was that there, not necessarily that there has to be a senior advocate on each one of those commissions, but that they don't necessarily look at senior issues, and to make sure that all of that, gets, I guess, just adding to the collaboration between City Council and City Government and Parks Commission. I think it's a valid
association. I think it shows where we're already going.
Right.
That this doesn't demand really, isn't going to demand too much new. But it might give us some information and help us focus.
Exactly. So I open it up, commissioners. Commissioner Lawrence.
A comment and a question. Comment is, I would like that you use SBAR for your staff report.
Thank you, as instructed.
It made it nice and clear, and so thank you. Then my question is, in one of the attachments, not in the staff report, but one of the attachments, it says there's no fee to join the APRC network of Asian family communities. But I guess I wanted a clarification as to what, if any, costs are there in terms of staffing or whatever that are entailed by becoming a part of this.
So there is a staff impact with any of the programs that we engage in. This was one of the goals that that ASAP set in terms of advocacy, and this being the first thing that they really wanted to focus on. And those goals came before your commission. I think the goal, though, is that the committee is really signing up to do the engagement on this issue. It is the committee members. Sandy drafted the letter that the mayor signed, and Legia met with the whole committee, and she did a great job drafting this, and other people gave feedback. While there's no piece of this, it doesn't have some staff piece. I was asked to have my name as the contact because I'm the ongoing person. Committees don't have the longevity typically that staff do. And at least with this phone number, you know, in some years down hence, there'll be another staff person there. So I was asked to do that, but we really had to have some discussion of what was being asked of me. And that's part of why we're here in front of your commission. It's not just the mayor signing up. That was part of this whole discussion. Well, if I'm going to have my name there, then you all have to agree. But if I'm going to agree, I need to know that the committee is really agreeing to do this work, that I would be the glue that holds it together. That's the role that staff often have.
So I can follow up then. So in terms of the budget, It will not have an effect on the budget.
That's not the intention to have an effect on the budget. We have no intention to ask for more staffing hours. We have no intention to hire consultants to do pieces of this. It is going to need to move at the pace that the committee can invest their time and effort in it. As far as making a city more age-friendly, yes, in the big picture, there are fiscal impacts, but I would guess that the city council also wouldn't be ready to dedicate new funds so much as to guide the existing expenditures, mm-hmm. right? You're already going to do a master plan. You're already going to fix the downtown. Let's think about these issues when we're using that money as we go forward.
And I can just kind of reinforce what Eileen's saying from the standpoint of the committee, the Ashland Senior Advisory Committee. We did talk quite a bit about before we put Eileen's name down, and we respect that staff time is really important, and it is something that we're taking on personally. I feel it's quite an important thing. I am willing to spend time. I'm probably going to a meeting in Portland next month related to it. We don't have a large group, so, you know, I can't say how many hours that's going to be for everybody, but it is one of our major goals. And as it is one of our goals, we need to put some time into it, and we will. I mean, we already have.
I don't, but what I think I'm hearing from you, I mean, is you don't see it impacting directly your hours extensively during the week. Is that a fair statement?
I don't see that. I see that it will have to, the project will have to move at the pace that the committee members can do.
So
that my work plan is very large already.
And the one thing I was disappointed in, if we're calling it an age-friendly community, and I don't know how to address this, and I just got to say it, that it doesn't talk about sustainability. Because we can't talk about age-friendly. We can't talk about friendly to our kids if our whole community is going to burn up, you know. And I would just like to pass that on somewhere up to, I don't think it's your place, you know, change it in our community necessarily. But, you know, I just flew over the state and then went in up north, and I'm just struck by how dry we are. And if nobody's looking at concerns like that, I don't think we're being very age-friendly.
Can I just ask you, what is it that you, how, in what way do you think we should be more sustainable?
Well, I think it lists 8 things, their domains of livability. I would think a 9th one, or included in one of those, is sustainability and perpetuity, you know, looking towards the future and our resources. I'm not clear on it, but I don't think you can talk about domain of livability without looking to the future in that sense.
Well, we'll put you in touch with.
We can put in, you know, that feedback we can give for the future. I mean, certainly within Oregon.
Yeah, and I think this is AARP who put this 8 things out. Yeah, and I think that's where we are. Is what would be appropriate for us would be to make that comment back to them.
Mm-hmm. Right, that's what I'm suggesting.
I think it's a good point.
What Sandy is maybe going to attend in a couple weeks is a gathering of the different players in Oregon that are working to see if Oregon can become an age-friendly state and make that step. And I think it would be very appropriate for that discussion to consider that as part of Oregon, and Oregon then leveraging that influence as a state larger body on AARP. I'm also curious whether there's something about that we could add here, even though it's not one of the domains. Have to read over it carefully again and see where it could fit. But that is certainly something that the city of Ashland has worked very hard on and could be considered one of our accomplishments in an age-friendly community to think about sustainability for our future. That certainly makes sense for an all-age-friendly community.
Maybe less for seniors in some ways.
We're all going to need age-friendly community someday. Hopefully there will be a community there for us.
Even those of us that don't need accommodations now can really benefit from what's there for our parents' generation. Right. Or being a working individual and taking care of parents is so many people in our community are.
And this is still my comment was in no way to denigrate or not to value what's going on.
I think it's an important comment, and I appreciate hearing it.
So we'd be looking for a recommendation that Park sign off on.
Mr. Light. Like a motion.
Yeah, a motion.
Well, I was having trouble kind of recommending one, so I'm going to try something a little different.
Okay.
I move that we support staff's recommendation for becoming part of AARP's network of age-friendly communities.
Second. Any further discussion?
I would just say that to me, that motion allows all the things that you recommended, so I don't think we need to say them.
Any other comments? None? Take a roll call vote.
Commissioner Long?
Yes.
Commissioner Bell?
Yes.
Commissioner Lewis?
Yes.
Commissioner Heller?
Yes.
Commissioner Gardner?
Yes.
Motion passes.
Thank you for your presentation and effort, and we'll get together.
I'll circle back with him on signing, and maybe we'll take a look at first and see if there's a way, any way that it could fit to add something that's sustainable.
Excellent.
Thank you.
All right.
Thank you.
Thanks for waiting through the line.
Yeah.
Thank you for changing the agenda.
Yes. Yes.
Okay. We'll bring up Park Superintendent Oxendine.
So, we've had a little bit of a rodent issue in parks, and it's been ongoing, I think, for quite some time. There's been a few previous attempts to deal with the situation using contractors. In the past, in particular, the Oklahoma Golf Course and Lithia Park. And I looked into it. I did a bunch of research trying to figure out how to control ground burrowing rodents, in particular California squirrels, digging squirrels, moles, and gophers. And you really have three or four different options for dealing with these. One is a live trap, which we've used in the past. Live traps are indiscriminate, so depending on the size, if you size them properly, you can catch what it is that you're looking to catch, hopefully, in a live trap. And I've got experience catching skunks on accident, but squirrels too, though, because they can get into the same size cage. The issue with live traps is that you have to deal with the rodent afterwards, and you have to find a humane way to do that, which we've struggled with doing in city limits. It also means that staff has contact with numerous rodents, and I'm not going to estimate or make assumptions about what type of diseases the rodents in the Rogue Valley are carrying because I don't know. But I do know that rodents do contract and carry certain diseases that can be passed on to humans. I looked at a sustainable, a more environmentally friendly poison. It's called Terad 3 Blocks, and it's organic, and it causes vitamin D3 poisoning. And the reason they've come up with this is because it doesn't translocate or doesn't cause secondary poisoning with other species. The problem with Terad 3 Blocks is it's not labeled in the state of Oregon to use for ground squirrels or gophers. It is in Australia, which is where I originally was excited because I looked it up and I was like, okay, it's labeled for that use. Not labeled for that use in the United States, and I called them and talked to them about that. And they're trying to get labeling in the United States, and it's been a very long struggle for them. You can also try this machine called a Rodinator. And a Rodinator is a long metal. The marketing for these things is a little bit disturbing on the scale of it demeans the value of rodents and the natural cycle in general. So I just find it hard, like, every pest company is stomping dead out, you know, like, kill these things as quickly as possible. This is the best destroying agent that you can use, the Rodinator, you know. They always come up with these names, like people are really trying to kill these things. And I'm like here trying to figure out like the least harmful way to eliminate a pest that we have to deal with for a safety issue, and because it's doing a lot of damage to our facilities. And so the Rodinator is a machine that uses acetylene gas mixed with hydrogen. And you pump it down into the hole and you use a barbecue lighter and it explodes the hole. Right? The problem with the Rodinator is that usually where you're doing these rodent extermination procedures, you're in dry, tall grass. And it's been known to catch things on fire before.
What's wrong with that?
We're trying to make sure there's something here for our children.
What could possibly go wrong?
Yeah.
It's also an explosion, C4. So things could go wrong. There are some safety concerns with it. But it is a more, there's no residual. And you don't have to deal with the rodents because they're dead in their burrows. Another way is burrow fumigation. And in the old days, people would pull a tractor up and they'd hook a rubber expandable hose to the back of the tractor exhaust and they'd pump it down into the holes. And they'd kill rodents with carbon monoxide poisoning. And it's pretty effective. But you have to drive a tractor around all over the place and stick this thing down into the holes. And you're just running diesel fuel for your tractor to exterminate rodents. So they have these, what I'm recommending, they have these gas bombs that are, well, I brought an example of them. So again,
no.
try to take the marketing campaign with a grain of salt here. But they are, the ingredients, it's sodium nitrate, sulfur, charcoal, and 3% catalyst, which is just the burn agent to get it to actually go through the whole cylinder. They have a little fuse in each one of them. You stick a fuse in the end. You find a burrow. You uncover the burrow entrance. You light the fuse. You stick it down into the burrow, and you fill the dirt in on top of it. And these, the sodium nitrate gas mixed with sulfur is a heavy gas, so it actually sits down in the tunnel as opposed to trying to float up as like hydrogen would for acetylene. It's not as light. So the good thing about burrow fumigation is that you don't have secondary poison. So the squirrel stays, or the squirrel, or the mole, or the gopher stays down in the hole. You don't have to deal with it. It rots and decomposes in that hole. You don't have the risk to the employees of dealing with kill traps, which is the fourth alternative that I came up with. We've used kill traps, and in fact, we have four kill traps set right now at National Park in the community garden. With signage around them. And kill traps are spring-loaded typically, and they have a pressure plate, and they slam down and shut, just like a rat trap would. The problem with kill traps is that they don't target what it is that you're trying to go for. So raccoons are very inquisitive creatures, and will stick their arm in these traps to try and get at food or whatever you baited the trap with. And all of a sudden, you've severely injured raccoon, or a possum, or a skunk. Anything that can get their nose in these things will go for them. We've set them for 3 weeks now. We haven't gotten anything down at Ashen Creek Park for two reasons. One, I think all the squirrels and the rodents are going into hibernation right now. They're down in their burrows, which brings up the next point of burrow fumigation. Now is the time of year to be able to burrow fumigate, because all of these ground squirrels and rodents have gone to ground to nest for the winter. It's easy to knock out large populations. I wanted to briefly address, too, some of the cultural practices, and not just cultural practices, but things that humans have done to cause these prolifications of rodents. And we have a drastically reduced snake population, drastically reduced coyote population, in particular in our urban environments, that were usually used as the biosync to deal with these animals. There's a level that was maintained in a natural order of things. And it's gotten fairly out of balance. And just as, I should have brought pictures, but just to see, if you go out to Oak Knoll and look between 8 and 9, there are so many squirrel holes right now that people are losing their golf balls every day in there. And the trees are literally, we have oak trees that are 100 years old out there that you can see root systems all over the ground, and they've tunneled completely underneath the trees, and they're chewing on the cambium of the roots. And they're doing damage to the oak trees, they're doing damage to the course, they've dug up our valve boxes, they've filled in the majority of our valve boxes with fresh soil, because it's anywhere there's a trench line that's gone through in the last 20 years, that soil is softer, so they'll take that trench line and they bring up that soil to the surface, and it's an everyday occurrence. And we have these specialty lawnmowers at the golf course in particular that are high-end reel mowers, and they mow very short blades of grass. And these mounds, you have to get off of your mower and level these mounds out before you can go through and mow over it. Otherwise, you're causing rocks and debris to get into these very sensitive, sharpened reels, and it's causing damage that way too. So I'm at an impasse of trying to figure out the most environmentally friendly way, you know, most, politically correct,
humane,
ethical, humane way to deal with rodents on a large scale.
Mike, have you talked to other folks who've
done borough fumigation?
Yeah, and I myself have done it for years. We used to use it at the university on a regular basis, and I worked for a arboretum, a 240-acre arboretum in Phoenix, Oregon, that had a ground squirrel population in the tens of thousands. And we set, originally I set 100 live traps, and I would go out and get about 90 squirrels a day in these live traps. And up there, it's outside city limits, and so shooting them was an option, and it was an easy option. And then I would get copper bullets as opposed to lead bullets, and then I would take the squirrels and I'd leave them out on the road for the red-tailed hawks to come and forage off. And other things, skunks.
Is there a downside to the borough fumigation that you see?
There is a downside to borough fumigation. A lot of times in a squirrel network, you have 50 entrances and 50 exits.
Right.
And so you need 15 or 20 employees out there, all with a couple of these gas sticks, and you have to find those burrows, kind of work in cohesion to light them all at the same time, get them down in there, fill in the holes. If you see gas coming up from anywhere, fill those in. The other downfall is that you can be 99% sure that these are ground squirrel holes that you're fumigating, but there is the possibility of hitting some animals that you're not intending to target that live in burrows as well. In our area, it's not as likely to get some sort of endangered ground nesting animal.
Salamanders, snakes,
owls, whippets.
Thank you a lot.
My issue is that it is an indiscriminate. It's an indiscriminate kill. And particularly someplace like Ashland Creek Park, there's other mammals that use those holes. Predators, for example, weasels. And I know they're there because I've seen them.
Yeah.
And that really is, bothersome to me to think, indiscriminate killing. That's why you talk about live traps. That's why you use live traps. I mean, rather than a kill trap, it's because you get to see what it is before you kill it. And I think that's really a good thing. So, I'm just having actually seen weasels down there and know that that's, they're predators.
Absolutely agree with that. It troubles me as well when it's something that I've thought about. I did justify it to myself in my own mind at the golf course in particular, not at Ashland Creek Park, but the amount of wild animals that are at the golf course is pretty low, only because the vibration and the frequency of mowing that goes on out there, there's not a lot of stuff that puts up with that type of non-wilderness experience out there. So very few snakes, which I think is a huge issue with why we have so many ground squirrels. And we actually looked, and I talked to Laura about this, is why don't we bring in some snakes? And the first thing that came to mind after we talked to a few people about it was snakes hate ground vibration. So every time you mow over their area, they want to leave. It freaks them out. We talked about, and what we have started doing actually, which is kind of an exciting thing, is when we do tree work, Pete, every Wednesday, Pete, our staff arborist, goes out to the golf course and we started doing a routine tree work program. And some of the larger trees that we've been pruning, we've gone up and actually, so for example, in blue spruce, which has proliferative needling from the branches, we've actually stripped the needles off of the branches on several sides of the top of the tree, providing for like natural hawk blinds, so the red-tailed hawks have a place to land comfortably and kind of see the surrounding. In particular, around 8 and 9, where the ground squirrel problem is the worst, trying to encourage natural predation of those rodents.
So we want a motion. I'm just having a hard time thinking about giving you anything really broad, but I think it sounds like your worst problems are at the golf course. I'm just going to, is that ask you, since it's a question answer, is that true?
The worst place for ground squirrels is at the golf course, and it's the most apparent there. The largest complaint, largest number of complaints we've gotten from citizens is at Ashen Creek Park.
Within the
community garden.
Well, see, I think the reason why you haven't caught anything there is because, you know, just putting a trap down doesn't do it. You've got to be observant, you've got to really strategize. Give them the traps and let them have at it.
Which traps?
These are kill traps. They're black metal, circular, about 6 or 8 inches long.
There's different kinds.
Yeah. There's a bunch of different kinds. These are the ones that we ended up buying. Nature Center actually ended up buying them for the community gardeners. I will say that even for our staff, they were very difficult to set. The spring is extremely strong. It takes 2 people to hold the trap safely, pull the thing back.
So there, that statement right there, safely, if there's an issue with trying to do something safely, I don't want volunteers doing it. And
the other part is the front of Lithia Park, the band show lawn going up to the Perazzi lawn, and then up at the volleyball courts and around the upper tennis court, we've noticed a huge insurgence of moles and gophers. And I don't know, and I'll research this, but the predators that you're talking about, weasels in particular, I don't know what their mounds look like, if they burrow up like a gopher does and create large...
No, they go into someone else's hole after it.
So I feel fairly confident in that case that if we are quick and we notice, because these mounds form every day. So every day staff goes out and knocks the mounds down. And so the next day if there's a mound, that happened within the last 8 to 10 hours or something. I feel fairly confident that moving that dirt, putting one of these down there and covering it back up will probably only kill it wherever they made that mound. Unless a weasel is coming in the meantime to hunt that gopher, which could happen. And we may, sadly, accidentally kill some weasels, which we can also do with these live traps. Or not live traps, the kill traps that we're going to set right now.
So you're planning on using these primarily at the golf course, or you're planning on using them, or the idea would be that we would use them everywhere?
I'd like to demo them at the golf course and see what kind of success we have, but I've had a large number of staff ask to be able to use them in areas where we're having gopher problems. So Lithia Park in particular.
And
North Mountain Park on the sports course.
And you said the 2 different gases are, is it sulfur?
Sodium nitrate.
Sodium nitrate, sulfur. And charcoal.
Well, the nerd stuff.
Yeah. Well, charcoal that part, right?
Mm-hmm. No, I mean, well, I say it's a nerd, but...
Yeah. The 3%, I'm not sure what it is exactly, but they call it like a... it's an adjunct. It's supposed to make it so that the cartridge burns in its entirety. It keeps it... Because the fuse is only this long. Once it starts... It has to continue that burn through the... So it's probably like... it could even be like lighter gel or something.
And they're effective. In other words, when you cover up the hole, you obviously... Not as much air gets in, but these work.
Yep.
I mean, they don't dud.
No.
So would it be helpful if we were to... If your goal was to start off using them at the golf course and see the success, if we were to support that, that would feel supportive? Or are you hoping for a greater vision?
I think there's a different impact at Ashland Creek Park. I think that was the point, wasn't it?
The highest impact is Ashland Creek Park.
Well, the highest
an unintended impact, the highest unintended impact would be at Ashland Creek Park.
Or North Mountain Park, or again, closer to...
Not the golf course. Not the golf course.
Yeah, and again, yes, there is even wetlands at the golf course, but I think in general, we look at the golf course, we don't think of it as a wildlife refuge or a wildlife corridor or any of those things. So I think, I'm reluctant, although I have to say, the product that you've chosen, I get that it's, you know, one of the least toxic, you know, I get that you spent time, because I look up the ingredients and blah, blah, blah. So, you know, basically eat bacon, you know, you're, this should be about
salt or sodium nitrate.
But it's the indiscriminate killing that really is a little tough for me. But I think using it at the golf course, which is already a much more toxic environment, you know, just from an environmental standpoint than anywhere else in our system, it seems easier to justify.
Yeah, I agree. Well, we're supposed to be turning into Audubon certified habitat and also pollinator habitat.
And the only one isn't indiscriminate killing is the hardest one is the live trap, and then you discriminately kill it. So it is, you know, I would.
Well, you do. I mean, that is discriminate killing. You kill.
And I've done it, and I maybe yes, other people here have too. And it's a sad world, but it's a sad world. Anyway, if we allow staff to make an attempt at not restrict it too much, you know, because there's problems all over the properties, and so just allow staff to use their own judgment and then come back. Sounds like this is a fairly sensitive time of year that it might, this product might work better, and come back and explain how it worked and, give us some feedback. I mean, obviously it's an issue. You made a great point of the issue, and I think, I'm all for allowing staff some freedom to make their own decisions, and then come back and report and say what works and what didn't. And, that's what I would hope for.
This is, I get that there's some sort of a time pressure, but again, and I think I could probably support the golf course, but I think we're gonna just kind of say, yeah, this becomes our new, what we're doing. I think it should be at a regular meeting. With television cameras, rather than, but I think we say, hey, we've got kind of an emergency situation at the golf course, and I can support that, but I really can't support, giving you, the ability just to use it wherever you think at this point. We need to experiment, get some feedback, before we generalize it. That's my opinion.
And when you said the Ashland Creek Park is also a problem, do you mean the community gardens, or do you mean the whole park?
Just the community gardens.
Well, that's where the complaints are coming from.
Yeah.
That's where we're seeing the impact. So,
but then these other roads are having an impact in the park, you're saying, as well. And that's coming from complaints from staff. That,
You know, for me, especially at the golf course, if they're potentially affecting the trees, you know, the heritage trees out there, you know, I mean, it's like that would be a concern to me that I think we need to address. But
the trees are probably why they're there, even though they're actually, that's the main reason.
What is their heritage school?
They're not.
Okay.
It's relay rounds.
I agree. I think we can come up with, we have rationales for the golf course that we could make a decision tonight, and I would support it if it was limited to the golf course.
So make a motion to basically pilot program the golf course with the incinerator devices.
incendiary.
Yeah, we could use a flame one in winter, couldn't we?
As recommended by staff.
Right.
I would say that
I appreciate that, and it's important to me to bring this to your attention because I think it's an important issue. I think technically our IPO policy exemption for the golf course probably already covers us at the golf course. And I think that Laura has actually used these in the past at the golf course, just hasn't been using them recently. And so I wanted to bring it to your attention in its entirety and include the golf course too, but was really looking for also the
and I'm not sure it actually does, but this, regardless, this makes it clear.
Okay, so we have a motion and a second. Do we need any more discussion, or what? Do you plan on coming back to us at some future date then about using them in other places?
Yes.
Okay.
With some narrative about how it went.
Any other discussion from commissioners? We'll take a roll call vote.
Commissioner Locke?
Yes.
Commissioner Bell?
Yes.
Commissioner Lewis?
Yes.
Commissioner Heller?
Yep.
Commissioner Gardner?
Yes.
Motion passes.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Mike.
Happy hunting.
Okay. Last item under new business is 2020 ERC meeting schedule discussion. This is informational at this point, but I'll turn it over to Director Black.
So,
unless somebody wants to make a motion.
Yeah, go ahead. We're bringing this up now because I do think it's timely because the City Council has amended their start times to 6 p.m. And so with that, over time, there becomes a new standard of start times for city meetings, because the City Council pretty much, you know, they're big dogs, I guess. They get the biggest crowds and the highest viewership, I guess. But I think that over time that the 6 o'clock will become the norm. So I'm suggesting that we do change our start time for business meetings to 6 p.m. And we'd like to propose that actually and get discussion going on that. Also, with that, originally we weren't going to talk about changing the study sessions from 5:30. The City Council didn't change their study sessions. But Sean was doing some investigation and looking into, you know, what it would take to get us in the council chambers for every one of our meetings to make it really consistent so that we were always in the council chambers. And if we were to look at going to a different date, that's what it would require, not date, day of the week. It would require us going to Wednesdays, and we could potentially, let me make sure I get this right. There would be a two-week gap, second and fourth Wednesdays, starting at 6 p.m. That is an option as well.
So it is an option to do third and fourth Wednesday?
That is also an option.
Okay, we could do that as well, yeah, which it's just, I think we can deal with either way. But I think there's definitely, as far as the start time goes, I think it makes a lot of sense to do what the City Council is doing. Because I think it's hard for the community to kind of try and remember what business meetings start at what time. And they're dealing with that right now at the City Council. They have people showing up at 7 for meetings that are starting at 6. But over time, people will recognize 6 p.m. as the start time. It'll take some time, but they'll recognize it as start time. And then we'll be the ones who are starting late. And so I think it makes sense to get on board with that and start at 6 p.m. The idea of doing Wednesdays is appealing to, I think, to us, because just being over in the council chambers, I think, makes logistics a lot easier for things like this, with the recording, being able to project, having enough room for audience members, recording video sometimes,
yeah,
if
potential
for special meetings, those types of things. It makes it a lot more conducive when those things do come up. Moving to Wednesday, I think it's something that it's not like we have hundreds of people at every one of our meetings. I think it would take a little bit of time, but people would realize, if they pay attention to the agendas, when the meetings are going to be. And moving them to Wednesdays, I'm not aware of any hardships that would cause. I don't know what's on TV Wednesday nights, but
That's where you're going. You just want to be home for the Monday Night Football.
No, that's not. That doesn't have anything to do with it. So anyways, we want to throw that out there. This is on, like Mike said, this is on the agenda for discussion.
we'd like to get this discussion started and start talking about it. So give you time to think about it. Kind of weigh in your mind what the pros and cons of moving would be.
So all our business and study sessions will be on Wednesdays and starting at 6.
Yes. Just to be as consistent as possible. But
is it possible to make it the second and the third Wednesdays?
Because I have a concert on the fourth Wednesday.
Yes, it is. If it's possible, do second
Wednesday
and fourth.
Wednesday is
completely open. Yeah.
Wednesday is completely open in council chambers.
So it could be first and second Wednesdays.
Or first and third.
Or first and second.
No, I like the idea of having that 2 weeks between would allow for more time for everybody. You know, if it's that study session and it's 2 weeks before, I think that would be a good pace.
It gives us turnaround time, and you'd see less of, well, we'll bring this back next month, and it gives us a little bit of time in between to maybe turn some things around that would have been a month to turn around. But I don't think it's going to be like that with everything. Like, I would still be coming back in a month with the Trails Master Plan, probably. You know,
and you have a pretty set schedule, and that would be important to...
Well, I have a meeting that is consistently on the fourth Wednesday. I mean, not that it all has to revolve around that, but I do have one there that would conflict with the fourth Wednesday. And it's also at 6.
And that would potentially be the business meeting then on the fourth Wednesday.
Well, the business meeting could be any week, any Wednesday of the whole month, whatever you decide. It could be the second, the third, the fourth, the first, whatever.
And usually,
Not,
we can change the whole thing up, but to have a study session and then logically have a business meeting after that and in the same month.
Yeah, so it could be, I think the options are, okay, so the options are to go with a 2 week gap, and that would be having work sessions on the first Wednesday and business meetings on the second or the third, or second and fourth.
No, second and fourth.
If we have 2 weeks in between.
Two weeks. Yeah.
So those are the two. Those are the only two options for having 2 weeks in between. And then you can see what the options are for 1 week in between. It'd be first and second, second and third, third and fourth.
Well, just speaking personally, I've tried to arrange my life to do all my teaching and my clinics and all my stuff on the second half of the month. Obviously, I can change some of it, but consistency is helpful for me. But it's not about me, but I just wanted to...
Yep.
A couple things. One is, this would actually, getting off Monday would mean we'd have two...
business days.
There's that.
I can't read your mind really, actually. So
it would mean some of our Mondays, like for holidays. So holidays, there aren't any holidays that consistently fall on Wednesdays. That's a good thing.
Yeah. I think there'd be fewer times when we'd have to change.
November seems to be issue with, so Veterans Day is on a Wednesday, and then you have the Wednesday before Thanksgiving. Veterans Day is on Wednesday the 11th.
But it's always on the 11th, so that changes.
No, I think they make it Monday. Yeah, the closest Monday.
Yeah, I think it is Monday. Yeah.
The November 11th City National Memo just came out, and it's the 11th.
It's the 11th.
It is the 11th, but it's not every Wednesday, every year, obviously.
So that's an anomaly, I think. It's usually Mondays. But
anyway, the other thing, I'm actually on board. I think this would be great. But I think the timing matters. I would not be to start it in January.
Why not?
Because it's not enough lead time. I and other people there's two things. One is just, if you plan your schedule around the Mondays, and all of a sudden it's Wednesday. Yeah. And that means, for me, it means I think I have some plans. My vacation, I try to, but the other thing is just for, I think it'd be good, I don't think it really matters when we started. You could say, well, it's the first of the year, but I don't think that really matters. This is something that happens every month. We could start it in late spring or something, and then we've had lots of time to give, you know, to give, you know, every time we do anything publicly, we could include, this is coming, this is, you know, so we have lots of ways to disseminate information.
Be in the parks.
Well, we could, yeah, I think that's a good point, and I think we could also, I think there's lots of different options. Probably you don't need to get into all the options, but we could give it enough lead time to make it work. We just wanted to put it out there. It seems like there's maybe some. I didn't hear from everybody.
Well,
but
so there's a conflict on the fourth Wednesdays for both of you guys. So I think we probably at this point will try to avoid that.
Yeah. Okay.
I just mentioned to Sean earlier, if you make it a 2-week gap, all that really means is you probably have more potential to miss a meeting if you go on a 2-week vacation, because there, you know, there's not going to be 3 weeks.
That's a good point, actually.
But, you know, it just kind of depends on the flexibility for getting. I mean, if we would be more productive if we had 2 weeks in between, it'd probably be worth it, but I don't know if it makes us more productive.
Yeah, I think potentially there'd be more potential people missing meetings.
Wouldn't it be better? I mean, because if the meetings are only a week apart, you only need to take a week off to miss 2 meetings.
Well, most people plan around it, then you have 3 weeks.
Exactly.
Where there isn't a meeting. So you have a longer period of time where you know.
But if you didn't plan around it, you probably only miss one meeting.
Well, right now, I mean, they're a week apart, usually.
So one other thing I just thought of was, you know, right now, it's kind of intense. For 2 weeks, we meet, and then we don't see each other we don't meet again for a while. If we, and I don't know what I like best, honestly, to tell you the truth, but
I can tell you, spaced out by 2 weeks, the first and the third Wednesdays sound great.
That
sounds excellent.
Yeah.
You work really well for me.
I love decisive.
I need to take more vacations. I don't know.
And if they are 2 weeks apart, then you do, I mean, it's only 2 weeks till the next meeting. That, to me, it's kind of like, I don't know. There's so many different ways to look at it.
Maybe we should do this. Maybe we should take Julian's suggestion and say that's what we want to think about. See how that works. So we change it to Wednesday, and it's the first and third Wednesdays.
But we don't want to think. I mean, once we do it, we want to be really clear that we're doing it, so we don't want to change it once we've said that.
Right. And I know, that's why I'm saying. But instead of putting every option on the table, why not just put this option and say, you know, think about how it's going to, you know, work with you, or, you know, like what conflicts come up, and then just that might be the potential solution.
Can we tie in Rick's suggestion starting in March, because I booked out classes and stuff?
Actually, I said May, but
whatever.
March sounds good. Yeah. But yeah, I think we would definitely not want to do it too quickly. Right. We'd want to give notice. But can I just ask, is there any reason why having the city council and the Parks Commission business meetings back to back would be a problem?
Would it be for you?
No, it wouldn't be a problem for me.
On the same week.
On the same week, yeah. This Tuesday and then Wednesday.
What's the difference? That's Monday and Tuesday.
Well, the reason I bring it up only because to see if there is an issue, if anybody perceives an issue, but also that's a pretty intense week for people who want to be involved in local politics. So I'm just throwing it out there. Just if it's not an issue, it's not an issue. It's not an issue for us on a staff level at all.
I think for people who are wanting to be involved in city government, they can get it all out of the way. One ball.
There you go. There you go. That's
a lot of posters.
That's a good point. So, well, I mean, there's, like we've been talking about, there's a million ways to look at all of this. I don't think the reason why maybe there was something behind setting up the meetings way, way, way back in the past where there, you know, all of the work was done on different weeks than what the other business meetings were for city council or something. I don't know, but I don't think, if it doesn't matter to you, it doesn't matter to us. So
I do have one question about when you would be thinking that the materials would come out. Friday's not a good
day. Okay, we anticipated that. We could do Thursdays. We could do Wednesdays.
See, for me, I don't see that really makes a difference. What's your set?
Yeah.
It really doesn't make a whole lot of
difference. It really doesn't. It doesn't. Unless tomorrow's Wednesday and it's due. But we can do Wednesday or Thursday. We could do either one of those.
You mean a week in advance?
Yeah. So I know as a planner, we always did Fridays, and it really is kind of a hardship on staff who has to stick around and wait for those things to be done, because a lot of times we are finishing the packet about 10 minutes before you guys see it. So
I think Thursday would be fine, but I think it's important to, at least it comes out at the end of the day, so then it's Friday, and it's like, well, oh shit, what about this? And you try to call Michael, and Michael's gone, on his river trip.
But I'll be back on Monday.
That was the plan.
Usually.
Yeah. Anyway, that's...
Yeah, I see what you're saying. We could easily do whatever day you want. If you want to see them a week in advance, we can make a policy it's a week in advance. Once we get in the swing of things, it doesn't matter.
So everybody's good with Wednesdays except for the fourth Wednesday at this point?
Yep.
Starting in March.
It's all about compromise.
It's just throwing it out there.
It's just compromise.
We're not voting on it.
No. I'm just saying, I'm just making sure that people understand what the options are. Because I'd say, so let's just say we're going to start in March, we'd probably want to make the decision in December.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
And I'm hoping to get a decision on dates in December so I can, if it's not changed, I need to book council chambers, I need to do the PO invoice for the mail.
Yeah, get a hold on that really fast.
Yeah.
And also they don't give it away.
Yes.
Put your deposit down.
The planning commission used to meet on Wednesdays, like back in the,
I think that's right.
On back when I was on it, so that's probably why it wasn't available.
And what did they change to Tuesdays? Or
is that what they mean now, Tuesdays?
Yeah.
I mean, I've been
to it. Must have changed.
I can't remember what day it was.
The historic commission's always been.
But do they meet in the council chambers?
In the
Siskiyou room, yeah. Yeah. Well, this is a good opportunity, I think, for the commission to be in the council chambers.
Yeah. I still think 7 is more civilized time. But I also know that for staff, it's really...
Well, I was going to say civilized for who?
Yeah. Right, I mean, just like this meeting, it's like,
yeah, right.
Oh wait, it's only quarter. It's only quarter. Great, but still,
some of our longer meetings, I'm aware of that. When they try to have kids come to the meeting, high school students, whatever. I'm staying late. I think there's an argument for going.
Yeah, when high school kids have to leave the meeting early because their item hasn't been gotten to by 9 p.m. And
they have to go to the pool to swim.
So, I would ask that you consider putting a cap on meetings as well. It doesn't happen very often, but if it's not like the city council where every meeting they're running up against their time limit. But if you're, it would be nice. It would be a civilized thing to do to cap the meetings. So.
At what, 2 hours?
Three.
So 9 o'clock. 6 to 9.
Two and a half.
Well, maybe.
I'm with you. Let's keep going down.
Maybe if the public only gets 4 minutes, maybe the commissioners only get 6.
It's not. Rick's going to say it's not the commissioner.
Maybe everyone will stand on the topic.
It's the rebuttal period.
Yeah.
Okay, well, we should think and we should be prepared to make a decision next month.
Nice.
To start sometime in 2020.
This one, well, better than I could have.
Why not just decide next? It's too soon to just decide next.
Yeah, we're not doing every other week yet, so.
No.
No, December, I think. would be great if we can do it in December. Then we can publish we can bring a calendar to you, and even though Sean actually has the calendar here, but, and then we can publish it in late December like we usually do.
Okay, discussion done. Any items from commissioners or staff?
Just briefly, a community member asked me about the community center and what's going to be happening with that. Do we have any?
So the community center, there's three buildings that a lot of people would identify as our buildings. And if I need to explain the difference between our buildings and city buildings.
I get a bunch of questions.
Yeah. Okay, so if that's clear, I won't go into it, but I'll just say what the three buildings are: Pioneer Hall, the Community Center, and the Band Shell. So as far as I know, there is talk about putting together a plan to address some of the needs that the city has with regard to facilities. Whether or not this is on the list or not, I have no idea. I couldn't tell you right now.
I just tell people to lobby the council and emphatically about they should demand this community center building because I explained to them what a huge loss it is for the community in general, and then us being able to have venues for the community, and it's a kind of a disaster, and there's just no discussion of it even. So I say, council, if they're going to float some bond, I would guess you could throw that out.
So I, just to let you know, whenever it comes up in meetings that I'm in and that there's any talk about what should happen with it, my standard response is, it would be a huge community loss to not have that building be repaired. It already is a huge loss. And to people who don't think, I try to express that they just need to look, because it really has affected things, and people really would like to see that, probably more than they'd like to see some other things in the community.
Is it going to be repaired or replaced?
There's no plans right now.
No plan at all.
I do have the engineer's construction report on it, and it seems fixable, but then I spent a lot of years fixing up older places, so I would go at it thinking, well, let's try to fix it, but then that's not always the thought process within the city.
That seems like a nice rectangular three-story office building. It would be just right.
People want to take the parking lot too and build a really massive building, and I don't dissuade that, but I'm going, hey, we need a community center, and it was a big loss. And so I encourage people, that's me, because everybody assumes it's far. Why aren't you guys fixing, you're spending all this money, why aren't you fixing the community center? Well, take that to the council, because we would like to rent it from them, I guess. Yeah, complicated.
Well, I had asked that this thing on our agenda, we get an answer for the question that Joel asked. And so in a way, it's less than satisfying that it's coming up here. I understand why you did that. But I really believe that it needs to be on, we need a staff report, and it's going to be obviously short and sweet, but it happens in front of the cameras at one of our regular meetings. So that we again just are on record as, hey, we rent this building from the city, and we understand it's a loss, but we don't have the isn't under our control to do something about it. I just think that needs to be just the same reason that you asked the question. It needs to be publicly stated.
Well, let's put it on the agenda then. You got that?
Yep.
Okay.
And it's going to be good if it's on an agenda where there's going to be some other big ticket items that people are going to get.
Like next week.
What's next week?
Yeah, I thought we just got done with all these big ticket items today.
So, yeah, we'll get it on. I don't know that we have any really big meetings like we have the last last few, but.
But anyway, that'd be ideal. That may not be possible, but.
Okay.
But I think that Joel's not the only one with this question.
Actually, it also might even fit into a park for you. In the sense of saying, many people have been asking.
So I think that you should, as commissioners, maybe you should reach out to the city council or mayor and ask them what their priority is. And they're right in the process right now of talking about this whatever, you know, and it has to do specifically with
facilities,
and so you know we can do the meeting and everything, but you also can ask them the question, and right now is the time when they're thinking about it the most.
Any other items, commissioners, staff?
I don't think so.
So we have a regular meeting next Monday, November 25th. We'll have the Lithia Park Master Plan presentation and several other items. And that's about it.
Okay. Boom. You know what? I will try to get it on next Monday's meeting, because we do have the Master Plan at Lithia Park.
Yeah, I was going to say that's
pretty big. That's what you were talking about. I didn't register.
Michael, is it appropriate to go to City Council and ask to speak about it?
I would, because you're a commissioner, I would advise you to try to talk to them one-on-one. That's what I would say. But you, any citizen can go to a council meeting. $4,000? But